This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, my guest is Jenny Ashford. She's been on once before talking about the Mammoth Mountain poltergeist. Tonight, we are going to be talking about her second book, which is The Rochdale Poltergeist, which she did with parapsychologist Steve Mera. We were trying to get Steve in on this, too, but he was unavailable when we were doing this. But she does have another book with Steve coming out, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I think it's called House of Fire and Whispers. And she'll be back. We'll have Steve on with that one so he can give some different insight into this stuff as well. Now, for some reason, we were having some weird feedback issues during this interview. So you may hear some clicks and some pops and a little bit of a hum, especially in the beginning. Whatever was happening, I could not get it to stop unless I turned my microphone off. So I would have to occasionally turn it off and on. You might hear a pop. I tried to remove most of them since this was pre-recorded, luckily. But whatever was going on, we couldn't figure out where it was coming from. It didn't happen in the next interview I did that night, so I really don't know what was up. So you're just going to have to forgive that little bit of a hum and the occasional pop. I apologize for that. Not usually something that happens. Next week, we're going to have David Matheson on, and he has some interesting stuff on star myths and how they affect us as a general culture. So that should be a really interesting conversation. After that, I believe we're going to have Gordon White on. And I will say in August, we're going to have David Politis back. Of course, if you want to help the show, go become a Patreon. You can do that at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can find all kinds of great stuff associated with the show. Links to all kinds of things, some free books, and all the shows we've ever done for free. All right, with no further ado, this is my interview with Jenny Ashford. And I'm speaking with Jenny Ashford, and we're going to be talking about the second of your books on poltergeist phenomena. This one is The Rochdale Poltergeist, correct?
Yes, it is.
And I had you on previously for the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist.
That's right, yep.
And you want to tell people a little how you got investigating poltergeists?
It was kind of odd, actually, because I'm a horror writer. I write fiction, mostly. But I actually got into writing poltergeist book because of Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, which I talked about in the last show back in April. And that was my boyfriend, Tom, told me about a poltergeist case that happened to him when he was, you know, 13 years old back in 1982. And, you know, he told me about his experiences and I got interested in it. So I kind of, you know, looked a little bit into it and wrote a book about it. And then from that, we contacted a parapsychologist in Britain named Steve Mera, and we sent him a copy of Mammoth Mountain, and he read it and reviewed it for his magazine, and mm-hmm. he liked it so much that he contacted us and started, you know, he started talking to Tom about Tom's case, and then Steve was saying, oh gosh, I have so many weird poltergeist cases. They were like comparing poltergeist notes and stuff like that, And so Tom was like, you know, Jenny's a writer. If you have any cases that you think would make an interesting book, you know. So we kind of talked about that. And he said, yeah, I have this case that I did in Rochdale back in 1996. And it was pretty weird. And it was like one of the weirdest cases he'd ever experienced. So he said, does she want to write a book about that? And I was like, yeah. So that's how that came about. So and you know, we've kind of... We kind of made friends with Steve, and now we're doing all these paranormal shows and paranormal books, and it's just been kind of strange, but in a good way.
Did you ever expect to be doing this type of stuff?
I did not really. I actually had, because I've always been a skeptic, and I was kind of interested in, you know, paranormal stuff when I was younger, maybe. I was into, you know, I was into, like, ghost stories and stuff when I was younger. I didn't really believe any of it. Maybe until, you know, until me and Tom got into talking about it, and I talked to his family about it, and then I got to talking to Steve Merritt, who's a parapsychologist who's been studying it for 30 years, and I'm like, well, maybe there's something to this. You know, they can't all be just making stuff up.
What, like, one of the things that people will come back with is, well, you're a horror writer, so how do we know any of this is real?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I don't know. I admit I did kind of, I have been asked that before, and it didn't really bother me, because I feel like, I mean, my horror is really not anything like my paranormal nonfiction. I write them, it's two very different styles. And when I write the paranormal nonfiction, I try very hard not to embellish anything. I want it to be very, I mean, particularly because, I mean, Steve Merritt, he's a parapsychologist. He's not, you know, a quote unquote ghost hunter person. You know, he's in like a scientific, you know, establishment. And so he's very stringent with his tests and everything like that. And he's very quick to say, you know, this was faked, or this, we didn't think it was anything to it, or whatever. So I really tried to follow that in my book, where it's like, I didn't want to, you know, I still want the book to be enjoyable to read, and I still want it to be creepy, because, you know, the things that happened were creepy, but I don't want it to seem like sensationalized. So I kind of made it very much just like, you know, kind of a litany of, you know, they arrived to the investigation, and then they did this, and they did that, and then this happened, and, you know, and then I have him kind of explaining what he thought it might be, or, you know. And if he thought that there was a rational explanation that there could be, then I would put that in there too. But like I said, I still want it to be a good read. But I don't want it to seem like, you know, like it's a horror movie. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to keep it kind of, you know, kind of not out there, you know.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't come across as if you're watching Conjuring.
Right, exactly. You know, it's not, it's very like analog. It's not CGI, you know. That's yeah.
the way you have it written, I mean, I think the thing about you being a fiction writer is you have experience writing to begin with.
Yeah.
So you're able to take these details and make the, you know, without sensationalizing them, and make them interesting.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope that was one of the things I did. I mean, what I like to do, the great thing about Steve too, is that how we got, you know, most of the material was, you know, we interviewed him on Skype, you know, he would just sit down with us for a few hours over however many days it was, and we would just talk to him on Skype, and we would record him. So, and then I would transcribe all the videos, and then I would just kind of piece the story together from there. So a lot of the work was kind of done for me, because he's very good at remembering details, and he's very good at keeping things in the proper order that they happened. And he's also really kind of good at, like, you know, cool turns of phrase, and, you know, he's good at making it interesting. So it wasn't really that hard for me to kind of massage it into like an interesting story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So tell us about Steve a little. Like, how long has he been investigating this stuff?
Probably about 35 years, I want to say. At least 30 years. And he's a really cool guy. I mean, I don't know like a huge amount about him when he was younger or whatever like that. But he works for something called Mappit, and it's in Manchester, and they originally started just doing UFOs, and I think that was back in the 80s, and then later they kind of expanded to all different paranormal things. So he's been doing this for a really long time, and he's actually the scientific establishment of parapsychology, which is, you know, the team that that went to investigate the Rochdale case. He's, you know, he was the founder of that.
And he's
also the owner. He does Phenomena magazine, which is like a monthly e-zine that has all paranormal stuff in it, UFO stuff, all that kind of things. And he has a TV show in the UK. It's a TV show or a web series, I can't remember exactly, but it's called The Phenomena Project. And they do, I think they're like hour-long episodes about various paranormal things.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So he's kind of, he's a busy guy. He's kind of, he's all over the paranormal, you know, community.
But he's mostly dealing with like ghost, poltergeist type paranormal stuff.
Yeah. Nowadays. Yeah. I think that's mostly, you know, what he's, well, you know, when he goes to investigate something, that's what it would be.
Okay. And he's based out of the UK.
Yeah. He lives in Manchester.
All right. So tell us a little about this Rochdale case.
Okay, this was a case, and it happened in 1996, and Rochdale is a little, it's a little town kind of outside of Manchester, almost like a suburb, and things had actually been going on at this house, like, for a long time before Steve got involved. I mean, the book I wrote, you know, it's mostly from Steve's point of view. Like, I kind of said some things that happened to the family before he got there, but I was mostly writing it from his point of view, so I kind of kept it to his perspective. But apparently for about 10 months before they called him, this family, the Gardner family, it was a woman and her husband and their 34-year-old daughter, or it was her 34-year-old daughter. They were having your kind of regular poltergeist things, you know, like things thrown around. They were hearing footsteps and stuff like that. But the weirdest thing about it was that they would have rain inside the house. And this was happening all the time. It was ruining all their furniture. And, you know, they had plastic sheeting all over everything. And they actually called the council, because it was a council house, like a rental property, and called them out there because they said, we don't know what's going on. And we think it's the, they thought it was the plumbing at first, obviously. So the council came out and checked and couldn't find anything. And then for a while that they thought that the Gardner family were faking and they were just throwing water around and destroying everything because they wanted to get moved to a better property. So, you know, in the end, they the family actually ended up going to the media because the council was kind of basically accusing them of faking. So they went to the media and, you know, I guess the newspaper guys came out and finally, the council ended up, or actually Steve Mara read about the case in the paper, and then he called the Rochdale council and asked, you know, do you want us to go investigate this and see if it's paranormal? And so basically that's how they got involved. And it had already been going on for almost a year at the point Steve became involved. And when Steve and his team went, and it was actually five of them altogether that went there, they saw some pretty amazing things. He actually did see it rain inside several times. And, he saw water coming out of the walls even when the family wasn't there. So, you know, it wasn't like the family could have been faking it or anything like that because they weren't even in the house when they saw some of the things.
There's a couple things about this case that make it very unusual. The water being one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it would literally rain inside.
Yeah. And actually, when Steve witnessed this, he said it wasn't like a little thing where it was like, oh, a little drip coming out of the ceiling. He was like, it was raining, like a rain shower. And he said the guy, Jim Gardner, the man who lived in the house, he said he was so used to it that he would keep an umbrella in the kitchen, you know, just propped up against the wall. Just, he said, because it happened all the time. So they'd be in the kitchen making some tea or something, and all of a sudden it would start raining, and he'd just put the umbrella up. So there it goes again, you know.
Wow.
And Steve said he thought that was very funny, that he was just so kind of blasé about it. He's like, oh, up goes the umbrella, you know.
Yeah, sure, what it's happening to you on a regular basis. How often were events happening to these people?
Pretty much. It happened at least a couple times a week, they said. That, I mean, things were happening every day, like kind of dishes flying around and footsteps, voices, things like that. They had voices coming out of a radio that wasn't plugged in and things like that. The rain thing, I think, was happening, you know, a couple times a week. And like I said, it was so often that they had to cover all their furniture with plastic because it was just ruining all their furniture. Everything was just getting wet all the time.
Now, tell us a little bit about the people who were having these experiences.
Well, they were actually an older couple. The woman, her name was Vera, and she was, I believe she was in her 60s or 70s at the time. And Jim was her husband, and he was her second husband. Her first husband had actually died in the house from a heart attack, I think. And so for a while, she actually thought the poltergeist was her dead husband haunting her. And she might still think that. I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. But Steve didn't think that. But she thought that because sometimes she would hear coughing that sounded like him. And she would hear like a man's footsteps, like in the back bedroom where he used to live, you know, and things like that. Now, the couple, Vera, she had a daughter named Jeanette. And Jeanette was 34, so a little old for a traditional poltergeist focus. But yeah. She also had some mental disabilities. So she had the mind of about maybe an 11 or 12 year old girl. And it came to light later, Steve and his team did not know this when they first went to the house because Vera and Jim had kind of not disclosed it. But when Steve was asking them, do you know, is there any trauma that Jeanette is going through that might be causing her to be, you know, the catalyst for all of this activity? And they said, oh, well, she had a child, and the child was taken away from her and put with a foster family because they didn't think that Jeanette was capable of taking care of it. Mm-hmm. And so this had obviously been very traumatic for her. And so that was one of the things that kind of, and the family had also been going through a lot of financial problems. And so that was one of the reasons that Steve kind of thought that maybe Jeanette was probably the focus. Although things did go on in the house when she wasn't in there, which he thought was kind of fascinating because he said, you know, that means that maybe she can do it from, you know, from somewhere else. She could do it remotely. You know, like the phenomena wasn't as pronounced when she wasn't in the house, but it was still, you know, present.
Yeah.
So, but I think in the end, I mean, you know, obviously it's a paranormal, so no one's going to say it was this or it was that. But Steve said he does believe that she was probably the focus of it. And when they moved the family to another house, because they did actually end up moving because they just couldn't, you know, they said it's just everything in the house is getting ruined and they can't deal with it anymore. So they got moved to another house. And after that happened, really no more paranormal activity took place, even in their new house. Now, there was some in the new house, but but it turned out when Steve went to investigate that Jeanette was faking it at the new place because she missed the attention that she had been getting at the original house when the actual poltergeist activity was going on. So when she got to the new house, she started throwing things around, like behind her mother's back.
Right.
But they caught her on a secret camera. So they knew it was her at the new house.
And that is such a common thing with genuine poltergeist cases where you get people faking little bits and pieces of it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that happened here. It happened in the Enfield case with the little girls would sometimes fake things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we talked about this when we were talking about Mammoth Mountain, how sometimes that can help the focus to actually make the real things happen because, you know, they fake something and someone sees it and believes it. And that gives the focus confidence to be able to do it, you know, paranormally, quote unquote.
Right. Even though they don't know they're doing
right,
it.
Right.
And then that was the second part that was really unusual is that this woman was so much older than the normal children who are normally around puberty when this stuff manifests.
Yeah. And that was why initially they weren't really sure what was causing it because, you know, there wasn't any of the standard kind of things that you would find in this kind of case normally. But after they kind of looked into the daughter somewhat, they pretty much figured out that that was what was causing it because a lot of the phenomena did focus around her also. Like a lot of it happened in her room and like especially all the objects that were thrown around, a lot of that happened in her room.
And it was their priest that actually told them about the daughter, right?
Yeah, I think it was actually. Now that you mention it, I was like, yeah, I don't even know if the family told them that, or the priest told them about that first, and then they asked the family about it, and they said, yeah.
Because it almost seems like once he went and talked to the priest, a lot of the things started falling into place.
Yeah. Which was another, I mean, Steve said he was kind of, you know, he wasn't mad at them, obviously, but he's like, you know, we're trying to help them, and, you know, maybe it's embarrassing for them to admit, but, you know, if they're trying to help them, they kind of need all the information they can get.
Not only that, but the family's probably thinking, what does that have to do with this?
Right, yeah.
This is my husband haunting us.
And that's essentially, like I said, Vera might still think that to this day if she's still alive, which I'm not sure, but I mean, she was kind of pretty adamant in that belief pretty much the whole time.
Now, when Steve and the group first got there, they did see water moving weirdly on the ceiling of the hallway. You have some pictures in your book of this.
Yeah, that's right. He said that was one of the most amazing things he'd ever seen. And it was just this tendril of water, and they saw it in the hallway up on the ceiling. And he said it just kind of came out of the ceiling, and then it just moved across the ceiling as though... So it was almost kind of like a snake or something like that. And he said it just moved across the ceiling. And he said it actually went around the light fixture as if avoiding the obstacle.
Which is bizarre.
Yeah. And they actually, they took a sample of that water. And, you know, he put it in his little sample jar. And then he went and sampled just some regular tap water from the bathroom. And when they were done with the case, they sent those two samples to a lab in Manchester, and the water that they collected off the ceiling had a humongous electrical charge, like something like 100 times higher than normal, or 1,000 times, I can't remember offhand, but it was some ridiculous number that you just don't see. They said the water was just like electrically charged. So they said there's no way that could have come out of the tap, because the tap water was normal.
Yeah. That's really fascinating, because it makes you wonder what the electrical charge has to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, because, and Steve will say this a lot too, that, you know, he thinks all of this kind of, you know, paranormal activity and stuff is generally caused by energy. Mm-hmm. And he said, and that's why one of the things they did on the Rochdale case is that after they get the family to move out, he said, one of the things we do is called fallowing the property, where, you know, whenever possible, they like to cut off all the power to the house and have nobody go in there for, you know, as long as it's feasible.
And I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah. And they said, actually, that if it's a poltergeist case, that usually will do the trick. You know, because the phenomena is not getting any energy from people, and it's not getting any energy from, you know, electricity. So, you know, they said that usually makes it die down. And actually, in the Rochdale case, he actually was able to fallow the property for almost a year. I think it was 11 months before they rented it out again. And actually, when he went back to the house, like a year and a half later, to see the new tenants, they had not experienced anything in the house. So evidently it did some good.
Yeah, it's almost like these things, although they're being generated by somebody, it's almost like they become their own entities that are being powered by somebody.
Yeah.
Because they're obviously not consciously controlling them.
Right.
And they seem to, you know, and the fact that they had experiences with her not there, I mean, she may have been generating it, or it may have just had enough energy to keep going for a little bit.
Yeah, that could be too. That she was just generating so much phenomena that it just kind of like continued like a, you know, like a residue kind of like after she wasn't there. Or I said, or that she could control it remotely, which is also a pretty fascinating possibility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know.
Now, when they did the investigation, one of the things he talks about is that they often leave the lights on.
Yeah. He's like, you know, you see all these ghost hunting shows on TV and stuff like that, and they're always like creeping around in the dark and stuff. And he's like, we hardly ever do that. He's like, because when you investigate in the dark, you know, you see things that aren't there. You hear things that aren't there. You know, things get exaggerated. You know, people get kind of hyped up and might mischaracterize things. So he said, wherever we can avoid it, we try not to, have the lights off when they're investigating. They pretty much leave all the lights on, except for, on the Rochdale case, I think they did have the lights off in one, room when they were sitting in there, the room that actually Verrett Gardner's husband had died in. And that was actually the room where Steve got pushed off of the bed. Yeah, so
why don't you give people an idea of what happened during that investigation? Because they had a few weird experiences there.
They did, yeah. And I'm trying to remember all of the things that happened. Well, as I just mentioned, one of the things, it was Steve and two of his colleagues were sitting in the back bedroom, which was actually not used at the time of the investigation, but it had been where Vera Gardner's husband had died. And they were sitting back there, and they actually were sitting in the dark, which they wouldn't usually do. And they heard a wheeze, like right behind them, like a man wheezing. And so Steve was going to turn around to look, and all of a sudden, he was pushed off the bed and across the room and into like a chest of drawers that was about 4 feet in front of him. And he said it happened so fast that he didn't even realize. He's like, just 1 second I was sitting on the bed and the next second I was across the room. And he said it kind of felt like, he said it felt like a punch, but it also felt like an electric shock at the same time. And there were actually, I put a picture in the book, there was a red mark on his back. We're having like a big kind of a bruise. And so he said that was actually the thing that made him almost like not want to do parapsychology anymore. Because he said, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff. He's like, but that was kind of the first time that I ever been like hit, you know?
And it's interesting that there was an electrical aspect there, that it felt almost electrical.
Yeah, that's what he said too. He's like, that's exactly, he's like I said, he said it felt like an electric shock, like an electric eel, like being hit by an electric eel. He said mm-hmm. That's what it felt like.
And they also got a picture of water on one of the doors, I believe.
Yeah, and that actually happened when one night when they had sent the family away, like they sent the family to stay with relatives overnight so the whole team could sit in the house and investigate without them there. And they were actually like just walking through the house, like investigating and recording and stuff. And all of a sudden the door from the living room to the kitchen, all this water just popped out on it, like little drops, and then just started to drip. And they all saw it. It's like suddenly there was no water. And then suddenly there was all these drops of water just popped right out of the door, and they just kept, and then the back of the door was dry.
The there was also, if I remember right, because I just finished reading it last night. I know when did this come out actually?
Last October.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was. You also had the statue that moved.
Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing was that it was a little statue of blind justice, and I think it was just made of plastic, and it had been. Well, they actually didn't know where it had been, but they were walking through the house and suddenly it was in the middle of the floor. Like, well, obviously this was not here before. And it wasn't laying down. It was standing up. And so like, well, gee, where'd that come from? So they wanted to see where it had come from. So they went back and looked at all their tapes, because they always do like 360 degree sweeps in all the rooms when they first get to a house. So they, you know, they can document where everything is. And so they watched all the 360 degree videos and they couldn't see it. They're like, it was, you know, it wasn't there. And so when the family came back the next day, you know, he picked up the statue and he said to Vera, is this yours? And she said, yeah, my ex-husband, you know, my dead husband bought me that when we were on vacation somewhere. And he said, well, where was it? And she said, well, it was right next to the TV. So it's always been there for years and years. And so they showed her the video and it was not there on the video. And this was the first day they arrived, like to do the investigation. They hadn't even really done any investigation. That was one of the first things they did, was take all these 360 degree sweeps in all the rooms. And so at some point, this statue had disappeared from where it had been and no one noticed. And then suddenly, you know, a few days later, it turns up just in the middle of the floor, like, hey, here I am. You know, and it, you know, so he's like, we've been walking through the house, and then, you know, this was right on the path from the living room into the kitchen. It's like, obviously, if it had been there before, we would have tripped right over it because it was standing right there. So, yeah, they never did figure out, and they don't know where it was all that time that it had been missing, because it had obviously been missing since they got there.
And when the room that Steve got pushed in, I think they also heard raspy breathing too, didn't they?
Yeah, that was the main room where they heard a lot of the breathing and stuff. And the weird thing was that Vera's husband, who had died in there, had, I believe, was it emphysema or some kind of breathing problem. And that's why she thought it was a ghost, because she said that sounded like him, like breathing and rasping hard in there like he used to do.
Yeah.
But that was why they thought. And there was another reason too, was because the radio in Jeanette's room, that, you know, it would have a voice come over it, even though it was unplugged and there weren't any batteries in it. And the voice sounded like a radio from a taxi. And that was one of the investigators said, oh, it sounds like a taxi radio, like someone, you know, telling their location or whatever. And then later they found out that Vera's dead husband had been a taxi driver, which they did not know at the time.
And didn't one of them hear a voice come out of that radio as well?
Yeah. And it actually, this is the part that creeped me out the most. It actually said, John's watching. And they found out later on that Vera's dead husband's name was John, which they didn't know when they got there.
And again, it's interesting because it's almost like the phenomena created itself around what they expected it to be.
Yeah. And actually, I think Steve thinks also that that's pretty much what happened. He's like, he didn't really think it was a haunting, but he said the poltergeist phenomena can mimic a haunting, and it will generally show you what you expect to see. And if you expect that it's the ghost of your dead husband, then that's what it will act like. So he thinks that was kind of the case there. I mean, a lot of the things that happened were just kind of random things, like, you know, why is the ceiling raining? You know, why are these teacups flying around? But, you know, some of the things like the coughing and the man's footsteps and the radio, you know, that stuff seemed like it kind of came out of their expectation.
Yeah.
That it was John Gardner.
Yeah. And that's really interesting in trying to figure out exactly how these things work.
Yeah. And
because would the daughter have thought it was, or did weird stuff start happening and they just thought, well, maybe it's my dead husband?
I think the weird stuff started happening first.
Yeah.
And then because I think it started with the rain.
Okay.
So I'm not entirely sure, but I think, because like I said, it had been going on for a while before Steve got there. And so all we kind of had to go on is like the couple newspaper articles about it. But I think the rain started first, and then, you know, later on they said, oh, well, we started hearing footsteps. And I think then she started to say, oh, maybe it's John come back to haunt me for some reason, even though Steve's told her, he's like, why, you know, why would he come back now? It's like, you know, he's been dead for however many years you've been dead. And it's like, you've been remarried for 2 years. It's like, why would he be mad about it suddenly? So, I mean, cause she had lived in the house for a long time, and it's, you know, it's not like there was any reason. It's not like he had just died and he'd be like, you're getting remarried. Oh no. You know what I mean?
It wasn't
that kind of situation.
Although oddly, you also find this phenomenon happening when things are changing and like, you know, moments of transition and stuff, but it doesn't seem like they were in any kind of transitional state at that point.
Yeah, that was another thing. I mean, other than, like I said, other than Jeanette's child being taken away, but I'm actually not real sure how long that had been, like before the phenomena started. Like, I'm not sure what the gap was from when her kid was taken away to when the phenomena started.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that actually might have been the catalyst that kicked it off.
Yeah, it just took a while to get to some kind of really severe, noticeable phenomena.
Yeah, yeah. Because obviously that was really traumatic. She was still visiting the kid, but you know, it didn't seem like it was a really good situation all around.
Now, you also have a list in there of some other water-related poltergeists, and most of them happen outdoors. You get, you know, weird poltergeist effects outdoors. I've heard of rocks raining outdoors and poltergeist effects, or indoors, but water raining inside is sort of rare, you said.
Yeah. I mean, mostly, I think most of the water manifestations, they tend to be kind of like unexplained puddles and things like that. The other main case was Donnie Decker. You know, the Stroudsburg Rain Man.
Right,
who,
right.
You know, made it rain inside his jail cell and in a couple of other places. And there was also, I think there was a case in the 50s, I want to say, called the Water Demon, where people, with this couple, it was an older couple, actually, who had water kind of shooting out of their walls.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, like, and that was another kind of case where they didn't have any kids or anything like that. It just suddenly all this water started shooting out of their concrete walls and they couldn't figure out why. But and it would make like a popping sound.
Yeah.
Time, like a gunshot or something.
I mean, I suppose, you know, when we're looking at this stuff, the rule would be generally it's created by kids who are, you know, again, in that transitional period. But, I mean, there's no reason why adults can't do it, too.
Yeah.
It's probably not as common.
Yeah.
So, now, your next book is going to be coming out, you said, August 1st?
Yeah, should be right around then, yeah.
And you want to give people just a slight teaser overview of what that case is?
Okay.
It's also with Steve, right?
Yeah, this is a case that Steve actually investigated just this year. He was there for 6 days this past January, and then he was there for another 8 days this past April. And, it was a case, but, and maybe some of your listeners have probably heard about it because it's pretty controversial. It's known as Demons in Seattle. It was on Ghost Adventures, and, Ghost Adventures actually didn't find anything, but, apparently the man who lives in the house is Keith Linder, and he had been experiencing paranormal phenomena since the day he moved into the house. And he started documenting it. And so he had about 3 or 4 years worth of stuff. I mean, he set up security cameras. He set up infrared detectors. He's just everywhere, like all in his house, because he was just fascinated. And he has a whole YouTube channel of videos and things like that. So he called in all these psychics to help him, and some people saw stuff, but nobody really helped him. And then he was on Ghost Adventures, and apparently when the episode came out, there was a backlash against him because the show hadn't recorded anything. So a lot of people thought him and his girlfriend were faking, and so they started getting a lot of negative publicity, and his girlfriend ended up leaving. And so he ended up contacting Steve after he read The Rochdale Poltergeist, actually. He found the book through Google, and he read it, and he said, oh, that sounds kind of similar. And he said, and that investigator sounds pretty cool. Like, he's, you know, got his stuff together, and he's, you know, a scientist and everything. So he wrote an email to Steve and asked if he would come help him. And Steve actually did not want to, because he said, you know, there has been so much negative publicity about the case. He's like, I don't know if I can be objective about it. And, you know, and some of the things that Keith was describing happening in the house were kind of, you know, amazing, like, and almost like too good to be true. Like, you know, he would go, like, he had one video where he went into his office and it was just destroyed. Like, there was just his drawers were pulled out. There were papers everywhere. There was like black writing on the wall saying die and things like that.
Yes. I do remember this.
Yeah. So Steve at first was reluctant, but finally Keith was like, you know, no one's helped me, please help me. And he's like, and this is going on, all this stuff is going on, and I don't know what to do. So Steve finally broke down and just said he would go. So he and his colleague Don Phillips flew to Seattle last January and investigated the house, and they found some significant paranormal activity.
Huh.
Which,
all right.
Yeah, so it actually, yeah, it ended up being a pretty, and actually, I, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but he said that on this case, he collected more clear EVPs than he's ever collected on ever. He said, I collected more EVPs on this case. I heard more in 14 days than I've heard on like a year's worth of other cases.
Huh.
And he's like, and a lot of them were clear as day. Like he played me some of them, and some of them are pretty eerie.
So once that comes out, we'll have you and Steve on.
Yes, that would be awesome.
We can go over that case. But your two books are currently available on Amazon, right?
Yep.
And those are?
The Rochdale Poltergeist, that's with Steve Mara, and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, that's with Tom Ross. Those are my paranormal nonfiction ones.
Do you have anything planned after this next one comes out?
I do, actually. I'm going to do, hopefully, this is the plan. I'm going to do a series of books about not just paranormal, but just about anything weird, just like old unsolved murders, like creepy missing person cases, you know, bizarre weather anomalies, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they're going to be like in themed volumes. And so I'm kind of shooting for, I want to have at least 4 volumes out. You know, I was going to say by the end of the year, but I don't know how that's going to work out, but we'll see. I'll try. But yeah, that's going to be my next project after I get the new book out and out of the way.
All right. Are you still writing fiction?
Sometimes. I don't have as much time to anymore, but I actually just started a story not too long ago, which maybe might turn into a novel. We'll see if, you know, if I have time to finish it. But I've been kind of going off on, you know, an Italian horror kick, you know. Lately, I mean, I was on one before, but now just recently I'm trying to watch. I was watching like all these giallos and stuff that I hadn't seen before, and I started writing about them on my blog and stuff. I said, you know what, I'm gonna write one of these. I'm gonna write like a Dario Argento type of story, like kind of like a supernatural murder mystery kind of. So I started writing one of those, so maybe it'll turn into a book, I don't know, we'll see. But it's, you know, it's going good so far.
Now, are you writing full-length novels, fictional, or are your collections of short stories?
I have a couple of novels. Really, my preferred form is short story because I don't have the patience like to write. You know, it's very hard. Like, I've written novels, but it's very hard for me to, like, keep track of one story for that long. Like, I forget what happened at the beginning, and, you know, it's much better if I could just write a short story and just be like, it's 2 days and it's done, you know what I mean? It's like, now I can write another one.
and to me, you know, sometimes I want to sit down and read a novel, and sometimes I just want a quick short story.
Yeah. And
novels seem to be more character focused a lot of times, you know, so if you really want to get deep into something and spend a while reading a book, but if you just want a cool, quick little, you know, okay, that was neat, you want a short story.
Yeah.
You figure Lovecraft wrote all short stories, but most people don't seem to realize that. He never wrote a novel.
Yeah.
So where can people find your blog and your fiction?
Well, my blog is goddessofhellfire.com. That's not a www in front of that. It's just goddessofhellfire.com. And, I put all my writing news on that. I write about movies. I write about all kinds of things. And, all my books are available on Amazon. I have an author page on there, and, everything should show up. You just search Jenny Ashford and my name turns up on there. All the books turn up on there.
Nice. Now, are you a graphic artist as well?
Yes, I am. That's my day job.
Ah, okay.
And I also, it's useful because I design all my own book covers and most of my own book covers. A couple of them I didn't, but yeah, I can do all, and I do all my own promo material and all that kind of stuff. I do my own book trailers and all that stuff. So it's a good talent to have, I guess.
So let me ask you this. From the time period before when you didn't believe in any of this stuff to the point where you are now, how have your views on stuff just in general changed? Like, do you see the world differently?
I guess, but that's the thing. It's like, that's kind of a hard question. I don't think it's changed my entire worldview so much, but the thing is, I had never, even when I was writing Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, which is the first, you know, paranormal nonfiction I wrote, I had never seen it. So it was just kind of academic for me. Like, I believed Tom and his family, obviously, but I'd never seen it. So I couldn't relate and I couldn't, you know, really get behind it in that way. But then, but then several months after that came out, and when we were working on the Rochdale book, and, you know, Tom was interviewing Steve. And so we were kind of talking about poltergeists all the time, and it actually started happening at our house. Like, Tom started doing it again, like, because he was the focus on the Mammoth Mountain case when he was younger.
Right.
So it actually started happening at our house. And it was so funny because we were just, you know, when we were just sitting there around the TV and two of our friends were here and Tom's mom was here and the remote control just suddenly flew off the table. And we're all just looking at each other going, you know, did we just see that? And then it's funny because I kind of immediately turned to Tom. I was like, did you do that? And he was like, yeah, I guess. He's like, I wasn't really, he was kind of zoning out at the time, but maybe that's what it takes. Amber, he has to be zoned out, but I mean, we all saw it. And actually, like, a bunch of other stuff happened that, like, the doorbell would ring in the middle of the night and no one would be there. The garage door would open in the middle of the night. One time the back door that goes from our front room out to the back patio was wide open, but the deadbolt was still engaged.
Oh.
So it, you know, it couldn't have, and we don't ever open that door anyway. It's like, that's, I think we've only opened it two times in like a whole 5 years we've lived here. But, mainly it's the TVs turn off and on by themselves. That happens a lot. That happens pretty much every other day. Like, we'll come out in the living room and the TV will be on. I'm like, oh, TV's on again.
So did any of this stuff happen prior to writing the Mammoth Mountain book?
No, it did not.
So it just kind of woke it back up again.
Yeah, it seems that that's what happened. And it's actually, it's funny because, I don't know, like, because I always just say to Tom, it's like, oh, I wish I could have seen it. I wish I could have seen it. And now I could have, now that I saw it, it's, I thought I would be scared, but it's kind of not, I don't know, it's not scary.
It just happens.
Yeah, it's almost just kind of like, oh, there it is. There it goes.
For sure, because nothing's scratching you. Nothing's hurting you.
Yeah, that's true. And it's just, you know, it's just weird.
Oh, it broke.
You know, it's just weird. I mean, the most violent thing it did was it knocked a couple of horse statues off the top of our kitchen cabinet. That was when Tom was very mad. He wasn't in the room with it at the time. He was in the bedroom. But in the kitchen, these two statues that are up, they just kind of flew off the top of the cabinet and smashed all over the kitchen floor. So
did it make you feel like, okay, yes, I was right, like, to believe him on this stuff?
Yeah. I was like, okay, you got me. You're right.
Because you can say you believe someone and you can believe them, but when you see it yourself, it kind of changes the tone.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of exactly what happened. Like, it wasn't like this huge, like, revelation or anything. It was just kind of like, oh, there it is. That's what you were talking about, you know? And it's, like I said, it wasn't scary exactly. I was just, it was almost a relief, kind of. I know
yeah,
it's not
okay,
a
yeah.
thing to say, but yeah. That I was like, oh, well, I finally saw it. Now I know what you're talking about all this time.
All right. Well, also, what do you write your horror fiction about anyway?
Oh, gosh, lots of different things. Most of my ideas, weirdly enough, come from nonfiction because I kind of almost prefer to read nonfiction than fiction.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah. So, and what I used to do, I haven't really done it lately, but what I used to do was I would go to the library, remember those? And I would go to the new, you know, releases section. And then I would just look through the nonfiction and just kind of grab like 10 books that looked interesting. They could be about like, it was like, oh, here's a book about taxidermy. I don't know anything about that. Here's a book about Queen Elizabeth. That sounds pretty good. You know what I mean? So, so I just kind of read everything I could get my hands on that sounded interesting. And a lot of the ideas for my fiction come from that. Like, I'll just read some weird little factoid, like in some book about some random thing that's not even scary. And I'll just be like, oh, what if I took that and mixed it with a mummy or, you know, something, not a mummy, obviously, but, you know, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I get a lot. I get a kind of lot of synergy ideas like that. I get ideas from nightmares also. I don't have a lot of nightmares, but every one I've ever had, I've turned into a story.
Yeah, I always like writing down my nightmares for potential stories.
Yeah.
What are your two novels about?
My first novel was, well, let's see. I got more than one, but how many do I have? I don't even remember.
I thought you said two.
Three, four, something like that.
Okay.
Three, I think it's three. I can't even remember. I have one called Red Menace, which was my most recent one, and that came out 2 years ago. And that's actually about witches, like old school witches. Mm. But it's also kind of cross-melded with, there's some serial killer stuff in there. There's some kind of Mask of the Red Death stuff in there. But I had been wanting to write something about old school witches because I kind of, they're like my favorite monster, and I feel like they are kind of neglected a little bit.
Yeah.
Or they were at the time I was writing it, because I'm like, I'm sick of vampires. I'm sick of werewolves. I'm sick of that kind of. You know what I mean? I said, I want some old hags, man. Like, you know, because those are my favorite stories when I was growing up. I said, God, I love old, scary witches. So I wanted to write something like that. So that's what Red Menace is about. And I also have one called The Five Poisons, which is about a girl who lives in a dimension that's kind of just underneath ours, where all of humans' nightmares come from. There are like these little shadow creatures that live down there that can like morph into whatever you're afraid of.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and they're kind of trying to escape and like repopulate the earth and, you know, make everybody go insane. So she's trying to stop them from doing that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a long book, but that's actually my favorite one, I think.
It's definitely a unique concept.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I can't even remember where I came up with that idea.
How long have you been writing fiction?
Oh, gosh. How old am I? Probably about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
I mean, okay. I started when I was really young. But, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the stuff I wrote when I was, like, a teenager really sucked, and I threw it away.
Well, sure.
So
when did you publish the first book?
I think 2005.
Okay.
But, I mean, I started out getting short stories and anthologies and stuff like that. And
okay.
Yeah, and then later on, like, I published novels. But I started with short stories.
Okay, all right. Well, and one more time, people can find you at?
I have a website at jennyashford.com, JennyAshford, and that has everything on it. That has all my links to my books, that has links to my blog, that has all my graphic design work, my portfolio, everything. And I also have, the blog is at goddessofhellfire.com. Mm-hmm. And I have an author page on Amazon also. Just search my name and all the books will come up like magic.
Okay. are any of them available physical or are they just ebooks?
All of them except one are available in both formats.
Okay.
The only one I have, like, kind of a graphic novel called The Tenebrist, which is about Caravaggio. The painter.
I don't know what that is.
The painter from the Italian Renaissance.
Oh, okay.
That murdered a guy. So it's kind of about that. It's kind of about him murdering a guy. But it's kind of illustrated. But obviously, I didn't want to do that one as an ebook because I thought it would lose, you know, it's the look of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah. That one's just in print. But all the other ones are print and ebook formats.
Okay. And you publish them yourself?
Two of them were published by Damnation Books. That's Red Menace and Bellwether were published by Damnation Books. The rest of them I published.
Okay, and all the paranormal books are self-published then?
Yeah.
All right, so we will be talking to you again after August 1st.
Okay, cool.
And the new one that people need to look out for is what?
House of Fire and Whispers, Investigating the Seattle Demon House. That's what it's called.
All right. Thank you, Jenny.
No problem. Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right. And that's the show for tonight. We'll have Jenny back to talk about her new book in a month or so. Lots of great stuff coming up over the summer. And we're going to take you out tonight with some Mechanism. This is Bring Back the Sun. Thank you.
だから一人で寂しい。